Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Penn State University has been criticized after its decision to disband the school's outdoors or outing club, the Nittany Grotto Caving Club, and the Nittany Divers Scuba Club. Penn State said the clubs were being eliminated because they presented an unacceptable safety risk. Speculation is the university was concerned about possible lawsuits over any injuries students in the clubs could sustain. Is it an example of a society that is more concerned about being sued than the benefits the activities may have? It's our conversation today with Kurt Schroeder, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. Representative Schroeder, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Scott. Glad to be with you.
And I call him Representative Schroeder because he's a former state representative. This is a conversation I'd like to hear what you have to say about lawsuits, whether we are too quick to sue, whether it's appropriate, whether we're just taking advantage of our rights. 1-800-729-7532 or send your email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We're not here to talk about the Penn State situation, but it got a lot of people talking just the potential for lawsuits out there. So my question to you as we start, even though I just said we're going to talk about Penn State a whole lot, your thoughts on what happened at Penn State?
Well, I think you have to ask yourself this. What has changed over the years to cause Penn State to take this rather drastic step? You know, the Penn State Outing Club has been around for 98 years, almost, a century it's been around. And the question is, has, camping, backpacking, hiking, canoeing, maintenance of trails, has that become any more dangerous over the past century? I think not. In fact, with safety equipment and whatnot, it might even be a little safer. But what has changed, I think, is really summed up by the words of the incoming president of the Penn State Outing Club, Christine Platt, who said, "Our increasingly litigious society is making it far more difficult for people to get outside without the fear of lawsuits for any misstep." And unfortunately, I think she's right. You know, when you have a deep-pocketed entity like Penn State, who reportedly has $1 million insurance policy that covers their clubs, well, it's a big, fat, huge target for plaintiffs' lawyers who, want to bring lawsuits, encourage parties and litigants to bring lawsuits. And, of course, they get a rather healthy contingency fee of at least 30%, higher percentage if it goes to trial, of any award. So there's a lot in it and a lot of incentive for plaintiff's attorneys to bring these lawsuits.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, when you talk about the change that we've had in society, there's been a change in thinking by people, too. And I guess my question, this is a kind of a chicken or an egg question, is what came first? Changing attitudes by the general public, or that there are more lawyers out there who specialize in personal injury?
Well, I believe there are more lawyers in general. And I believe what happens is because of the overabundance of lawyers. And look, I'm one myself by background. I don't actively practice or anything. But because of the abundance of lawyers out there, they constantly need to find new ways, new causes of actions, be inventive, if you will, in pushing the limits of the law and stretching the law so that they can bring more lawsuits in order to make their living. It's, a matter of economic survival, I think, for a lot of them. And in the end, we pay the price in society. Until now, it's been mostly businesses, large and small, healthcare entities, hospitals, doctors and everything, who have felt the brunt of this. But now, really, for I think the first time, we're seeing it extend into other areas. Now college students are feeling the brunt of some of this lawsuit abuse that is running rampant out there.
You said that the day may come where we all are sitting indoors in front of a TV or a computer screen because we're afraid to go outdoors. I assume what you mean by that is that the Penn State decision and what happened at Penn State is not unusual.
Well, I think it's not unusual. It seems to be happening increasingly today. Every entity out there, whether it's a nonprofit organization or whether it's a business that's selling a product or a service, they are more and more concerned about lawsuits and trying to protect themselves from lawsuits so that they can either continue to provide the economic benefit of their business or to provide whatever services and activities a nonprofit organization might offer. So it's very much on the minds of these entities.
But was that an exaggeration? Were you trying to make a point through exaggerating that we all will be in front of a TV screen or a computer screen?
Well, I don't know if I said we'll all be in front of a TV or computer screen. I think that, you know, was maybe an inference taken from the incoming president of the Outing Club. Hopefully it doesn't get to that. It would be ridiculous if we were all so scared of lawsuits that we ceased that type of activity. Nonetheless, while many people are quick to point the finger at Penn State for this decision, let's face it, Penn State is just reacting to the realities of the world around them. They're an easy target to point the finger and say, aha, you overreacted. You shouldn't have shut these clubs down. Look at the great activities they provide to your students. But in the end, Penn State has to protect itself as a university as well.
But the history of those three clubs, have there been lawsuits that you're aware of?
I don't have a relationship with any of those clubs or the individual in it. I just in reviewing a few things last night, read an article where someone said there haven't been any injuries. There haven't been any mishaps. So if there haven't been any injuries or mishaps in those clubs, then it's probably safe to say that there haven't been, a barrage of lawsuits that have, caused Penn State to make this decision. But when they did their risk assessment, nonetheless, they determined, and the risk assessment has not been released to either the clubs or the public yet, from what I understand. It's still, under seal, I guess, at Penn State. But there's something in there that caused them to make this decision. And let's face it, part of these calculations, part of the decision-making in anything like this, gets down to money. And the exposure, the liability exposure that they see themselves having.
Let's take some phone calls. Gary is in Juniata County. Gary, how you doing?
Okay. Hey, we have the farm, and we have guests come on the farm, and the representative will know that several times now the legislature has tried to pass a limited liability to help protect farmers, because there's very few farms now that will let people come and pick their own or even have some roadside stands or whatever, because they're afraid of the liability. And we have people from all over the world. I can tell you the first thing they see when they come down is all the horses. We have 20-some full-size horses and some draft horses and miniature horses and whatever. But we've had people from France 2 years ago that looked at us and said, well, if I fall off your horse, I can sue you. They just don't get the whole concept. So it isn't worldwide. It's just the idea that we need to lower the liability, and we have a bill, I think it's Senate Bill 820. Hopefully it'll go forward. Senator Almont's proposing it, but to help lower the liability so people can go back on the farm and do some activities and have the farmer not worry quite so much about the liability.
So, Gary, real quick, I just wanted to clarify what you had said. You say that when you had people from France, you had people coming from other countries, that they don't understand the concept of someone suing even though they fall off your horse.
Yeah, that's, like I said, the part that people don't get when they come is they just want to do activities. And, yeah, some of these activities are riskier than others. People have to assume the risk. It's that simple. If you cross a road and you cross against a traffic light, you're assuming that risk, that there's nobody coming. And I don't understand why this isn't an easy concept for people to understand. If you go to a different place and you're not used to that place, if you follow simple rules and simple, washing your hands procedures, you're going to be fine. But, you can't cover everything. But I can tell you, in 20 years, we have never had a guest injured for any injury, per se.
Right.
Hey, thank you very much for your call, Gary. What about that?
The the caller makes a good point. Farmers, it's no news to people that farmers are, finding themselves in, some difficult straits these days, able to make a living and keep their farms up and active. So they're oftentimes seeking other ways to stay profitable and to support their families on these farms. A lot of farmers would like to open their properties up for different recreational uses. Yet because of the threat of liability, they're unwilling to do that. And there's legislation that has passed the House and is in the Senate right now, House Bill 544, that would provide a limited form of liability protection for farmers who want to open their properties for recreational use. And just like this gentleman said, whether it's putting up a stand or inviting people onto that property, because farming is a commercial type property, it raises the risk of them being responsible for some accident, whether they caused it or not, that occurred on their property, to an unacceptable level. And therefore, many farmers are just not able to do that. So that's a constant issue that we are hearing about. In my organization, the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform, we support these bills that the gentleman was talking about.
Well, let's have you describe what your organization does.
Sure. The Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform, we're a bipartisan organization in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We are comprised of various small business, large business, medical, healthcare, professional, nonprofit type of organizations.
That can be sued.
That can be sued, sure. That have come together to fight for, what we believe is needed to be, balanced and fair changes to our court system. So we've been around for a little over a year. There's a couple pieces of legislation that we've worked actively on. And we are, the voice of change and the voice of reform, if you will, for civil litigation and for liability reform in the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to take some more phone calls here in just a moment. We often hear about in the news, it becomes newsworthy when you hear about a frivolous lawsuit someone determines is frivolous, mm-hmm. but people's reaction to a high jury award or punitive damages sometimes is, you got to be kidding me. How did that happen? But at the same time, don't want to make it sound as if there are not entities that make some irresponsible decisions,
sure.
or have some unsafe or make some mistakes and the courts are the only way to make them pay for that.
No argument here. In fact, our organization takes the position that if someone is legitimately injured or legitimately aggrieved, and it's the fault of another party, that person should be adequately compensated. Problem we have is when it goes from adequate compensation to basically enrichment, with a jury award or a verdict that is, all out of proportion to the actual harm caused. And once again, quite often, it's the plaintiff's attorney that makes out better than anyone because they're getting a huge cut of that verdict or of that judgment. And it really tends to skew the system. There's a lot of different ways we could do it. There are reasons why people in other countries and European countries don't understand our system. Some of them do things very differently, and I think we should take a look at some of those.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Kurt Schroeder, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. Talking about lawsuits and talking about liability, a lot of different issues surrounding this. If you have a question or a comment, like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Let's go to Jim in Enola. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim.
I, as you know, I'm an active hiker and backpacker, and I tend to agree with your guest that we do need lawsuit reform in some areas. But I think there's another problem here. It's that organizations like Penn State are just not properly looking at the risks of certain kinds of behavior. I mean, statistically speaking, the most dangerous thing any of us do is drive a car, but Penn State is not banning their students from driving cars. And how about coaches being in contact with little boys? They're not banning that either, and they're not banning co-eds having parties with alcohol. And there have been, you know, demonstrated instances of organizations like Penn State getting into a lot of trouble with them. I mean, statistically speaking, I lead a lot of hikes and going backpacking trips and stuff. Statistically speaking, the most dangerous thing that you do is drive to the trailhead, not hike itself. I just think you have organizations like Penn State engaging in a lot of groupthink and not really looking at the risks. I would really like to see, because Penn State is a public-funded organization, I think they need to show us the data. You know, what's the data that shows that hiking, backpacking, and canoeing and those sorts of things are demonstrably way more dangerous than co-ed alcohol parties or, other kinds of things like driving cars.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for your call. What about that? I mean, that is, after this case became publicized, there were a lot of people who said, what if, or what about?
Sure.
What about football? That Penn State is well known for the kind of injuries and the liability there with injuries. So weighing the risk. And the point that that Jim makes about Penn State being a public university that has a responsibility to show what data they used.
Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, their internal reports and this risk assessment, I don't know where it falls under, you know, the categories of public information or under the right to know. I do believe it would be helpful to see that report and have Penn State release it. And I know that the organizations we discussed are, in fact, trying to get that information. Whether they will or not remains to be seen. But you know, you can't just go and ban there's risk in nearly everything we do, as the caller correctly pointed out. There's a risk of driving, you know, your car to a Penn State outing or to a Penn State football game. You know, there are other risks that he mentioned. We will never live in a risk-free society, I think, is the bigger point. And there are some risks that we have chosen to accept as acceptable, and there are other risks that, you know, that we have not so much. But I think, the constant threat, the constant fear of lawsuits when you're a deep-pocketed entity like Penn State, you really have a target on your back. Everyone out there knows it, and, you know, they will try to take advantage of it.
We have an email here, and I was going to bring this up anyway because Jim mentioned alcohol. Penn State said that one of the reasons that they decided to disband this club, that alcohol was used by members of this club. Now, that is something that the club members deny.
Right. I'm aware that there's that dispute, sure.
But still, if alcohol is a factor here, does that change anything?
Well, if alcohol is a factor, that would certainly raise the risk. Remember, at the start of the show, my point was I don't believe these activities have become any more risky over the years. If alcohol is a factor, well, then that very well could raise the risk. But as you pointed out, there has been no proof of that so far. And in fact, the clubs have denied the use of alcohol and have made some persuasive arguments about how alcohol is just counterproductive to the activities that many of these clubs do.
Another email from Steve in Lebanon says, do signed waivers not effectively protect entities from liability suits?
You know, it depends. I'm not an expert on signed waivers, and it's probably better to have one than to not have one. But you know, you get into such concepts of contracts of adhesion in which there's real no negotiating power, and the party that has to sign it or else they don't get to participate, they don't get to do this or that, you know, sometimes are able, it seems, to find ways around, you know, these waivers and whatnot. It's a good question. It's one I would need to do some more legal research on in order to determine, you know, whether they're exactly 100% effective. I have a feeling they're not.
You said earlier, and I want to get into what your organization is ultimately looking for, but there have been some reforms over the past decade or so. I can remember a time when many people who wanted to file suit would go to Philadelphia. because Philadelphia had a reputation of giving out higher, much higher jury awards or rewards from awards from the court. In Pennsylvania, you can't do that now. It was known as shopping, but you can't do that now. It has to be related to the jurisdiction where the participants in the suit or where an incident actually occurred. So has that changed anything?
Let me just offer one clarification of that, if I may. What you're talking about was changes made back in the early 2000s. I forget the exact year. Those were changes made to medical malpractice suits in Pennsylvania.
All right. Okay.
And you are correct. Under medical malpractice right now, as a result of those changes in early 2000s, you can only sue in Philadelphia if the cause of action occurred in Philadelphia. So we have given, you know, a degree of protection from this, you know, what they call forum shopping. I prefer to call it litigation tourism, actually, which Philadelphia is most welcoming of their litigation tourists. Other types of lawsuits, personal injury lawsuits, mass tort lawsuits, you name it, they do not have that same type of venue protection that will keep a lot of lawsuits out of Philadelphia. So what you have going on is any attorney, and I'll say any plaintiff's attorney who's worth their salt, okay, will try to get the case in Philadelphia if there's even the slimmest connection to the city of Philadelphia. And what you also have now are mass tort drug cases, prescription drug cases, and things like that, where out-of-state plaintiffs are flooding the Philadelphia court system because there's jurisdiction in Pennsylvania, and if there's jurisdiction in Pennsylvania, well, they're going to try to get it in Philadelphia because they know that that's where the chance of hitting the litigation jackpot really is. Not so much in the other counties, although there can be exceptions. Other counties in the state are, you know, much more reasonable in their jury awards. But for Philadelphia, it's a real lottery down there.
Why?
And everyone hopes to hit it.
Why?
You know, many people have asked that question. I don't know if we know the exact reason why, but for whatever reason, the juries are. I'll be kind and say most generous in the city of Philadelphia. So we would like to see the same type of venue reform that would require the cause of action to be brought in a county in which the injury or the occurrence or whatever being sued over, you know, where that takes place. Because crowding up the Philadelphia court system, all that does is stand in the way of those who need to use the Philadelphia court system and get their justice. So let's let the Philadelphia court system deal with causes of action and the people in Philadelphia, and the rest of the state and all the out-of-staters who are trying to get into Philadelphia to bring their cases. Let's let them, you know, have jurisdiction and venue elsewhere.
Clarification. In a criminal case, when a jury comes back with a decision that a judge may not agree with or looks at it and says that the evidence just doesn't match up with that decision that a jury has made, in a civil case like what we're talking about mm-hmm. here, does a judge have that same discretion?
They do. It's a term I believe it's called remittitor, and the judge can shape the verdict, mold the verdict downwards if he or she feels that it is out of proportion. They cannot increase the jury verdict, but they can, you know, within the top limit of the jury verdict, mold it down. Does that happen? It sometimes does, sure.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what we were talking about earlier and what your organization is looking for is, you talked about these out-of-whack jury awards, you know, and how they relate to, you know, whether the kind of money that an award will come back from a jury, you know, does it make sense for a plaintiff to get that kind of money based on what they're suing on? How do you, you know, who makes that decision? I mean, you have a jury making that decision. Shouldn't that be enough?
Well, each case has to be judged upon its own facts, first of all. There's no doubt about that and no disputing that. But when a court, such as the Common Pleas of Philadelphia, continues to be notorious for awarding, very high, very substantial verdicts that, you know, is every defendant's nightmare being dragged into the Philadelphia court system. You know, that has economic impact on all the rest of us. That, you know, those awards and those verdicts add to the cost of products. They add to the cost of services as the companies or entities pay more for their liability insurance. Or in the case of small businesses, they're often not insured with, you know, high levels of liability insurance. Small businesses quite often have to defend lawsuits themselves and pay any settlement or verdict themselves. So small businesses are particularly hit hard in this litigation environment that we are in right now.
You described or listed businesses, small business, large businesses, medical facilities that you represent. There may be some cynics out there who say, well, what you're doing is you're representing the big guy, that the everyday citizen, that you're trying to take away their rights.
Let me say this. First of all, we're not trying to take away any rights. As I said, we believe if a person is legitimately injured or aggrieved, they have a right to be compensated and made whole. Okay, that's what all the critics say about us, and they try to get people to believe that, but that is not the case. You know, we want to do things like prevent the massive verdicts that are out of proportion, like you just mentioned, but we also want to cut down on, you know, frivolous lawsuits as well. You know, when you have cases being filed against the maker of Junior Mints because the mints don't quite come to the top of the packaging, or you have cases filed against Starbucks because the baristas are putting too much cream and not enough coffee, or maybe it's the other way around, I'm not sure. When you have cases being filed against Home Depot because their 4x4s, after they dry and shrink, don't quite measure 4x4. And I could go on with numerous examples. Oh, let's not forget the Subway hoagie case where the footlong sandwich only measured 11.5 inches. All of those became cases, many of them class action cases, and are just the type of ridiculous lawsuits that the average person looks at and just shakes their head and says, I can't believe this is going on in our system of civil justice today.
And I'm not supporting or in support of the cases you just listed, but the question I would ask to push back a little bit is, what can a customer do if they do find that 11.5 inch sub that is advertised as a 12-inch sub, or the Junior Mints that are not
well, full? The customer has to the customer should realize, and of course they're not told this by the plaintiff's attorneys that are egging them on in hopes of a huge payday through a class action lawsuit. But what they need to realize is that the same amount of dough is in every single piece of Subway sandwich, in the bread, but during the baking process, you know, it shrinks a bit or comes out somewhat different sizes.
I can't believe we're talking about this.
I can't believe it either, but this is the type of litigation that we're seeing out there, and which is occurring all across the country.
But what are the alternatives, getting back to my original question?
Well, let's...
Just not go to where a place that's making 11.5-inch subs.
Sure. Or realize that it's not a lawsuit or worthy of a lawsuit if the bread in the sub is a little smaller. It'll weigh the same amount, and the Junior Mints, after all, are sold by weight. Okay, yeah. They're sold by weight, not by volume. So they're, like I said, they're not. That's not explained to it by the plaintiff's attorneys, because the plaintiff's attorneys wants to get in there, get the suit, try to bring a class action, because class actions benefit primarily the plaintiff's attorneys only. They get millions, while the plaintiffs in the class usually only get pennies in those lawsuits. That's what a lot of people don't know. But they're a bonanza, an absolute bonanza for the attorneys that bring them. Next to nothing, the litigants themselves, the people that bring the cases.
Let's take another call. Barbara is in Harrisburg. Barbara, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about what is the real value of personal umbrella liability policies when a homeowner has already purchased all the additional insurance coverage that most homeowners purchase?
Well, it probably depends on the situation. Sometimes the liability policy, the umbrella policy that you mentioned, might carry excess coverage. In other words, it might be above the limits of the other insurance that the homeowner or the business would purchase. So sometimes there is that advantage to getting a higher coverage amount. And the more assets you have, the more money your business is worth, well, the higher amount of insurance you usually want to have covering you.
We only have a few more minutes left, but one particular instance that I did want to bring up with you. I was looking at your website, and you talk about the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. and we know that there are a number of states, counties across the country and here in Pennsylvania that are suing pharmaceutical companies that, you know, saying in essence that they misled doctors, they misled customers, and that has contributed to the opioid crisis. You say that that shouldn't happen, or it shouldn't happen as look at as a cash cow. Why not? I mean, that would seem to be a case that would be perfect if people have been misled.
Well, I guess the question is, and it still remains to be seen, you know, have people been misled? Let's not forget that it's not the pharmaceutical companies that prescribe these drugs. They're prescribed by, you know, physicians. And in the end, it is the, you know, it is usually physicians that make these decisions. Now, there's a real question, you know, about advertising and promotional aspects of the pharmaceutical industry that is the subject of these lawsuits. But the reality is, many governments, whether it's the state, if Pennsylvania decides to jump in on these lawsuits, whether it's a cash-strapped government like, I don't know, maybe Bensalem Township in the eastern part of the state, they're looking to fill up their coffers, fill up their tax
How do you know
coffers.
That?
Well, you just question, why else would they bring it? They feel
because
they're entitled.
They have a lot of people who are addicted to opioids,
and that's not why is that the problem of the municipal government then? You know, if those people who are addicted to opioids were bringing these lawsuits on behalf of themselves and saying, well, look, you know, I was injured irreparably because of the involvement, whether it's the pharmaceutical company, the physicians, whoever prescribed the drugs, you know, that might be one thing. But there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, local governments, counties, and perhaps even the state will be looking to fill its budget gap at some point on the backs of manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies, which is one of the biggest industries in the state, employs thousands of people in the state of Pennsylvania. And let's not forget, although some of their products have risks, like opioids, let's not forget the life-saving products that many of us rely on, you know, through the research and development and time and effort and expenditures that these pharmaceutical companies do. They're very easy to demonize because of, you know, one particular drug or the other. But they have a very, you know, useful, life-saving, you know, health-improving role in our society as well. So there has to be a balance.
You know, I wish we had more time, Representative Schroeder. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Today. Kurt Schroeder is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Civil Justice Reform. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. WITF's Capitol Bureau Chief Katie Meyer has followed the three Republicans running for governor and joins us to provide some insight on today's program, as well as talk about a few other issues at the state capitol. Katie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. I've talked with a lot of candidates over the last 3 weeks, Katie, but you actually went out on the campaign trail with the three Republicans competing with one another so that they could win the nomination and take on incumbent Governor Tom Wolf this fall.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Overall, your thoughts on following the three Republicans on the campaign trail?
Well, you know, it has been interesting. I think this race has been sort of marked by Scott Wagner, who is, you know, the party-endorsed candidate, sort of seen as the front runner because he has all this money and then all this party, you know, might behind him. So we've got Scott Wagner and Paul Mango both kind of going for this, I guess, most conservative title. Wagner has said, you know, it's not about who's the most conservative, but Mango repeatedly has said, well, I am the most conservative. And Wagner certainly seems to be attempting to contest that with, you know, some of the positions he's taken. So, I mean, I think there's no doubt both of them are like the farther right candidates and are, you know, trying to prove themselves as the correct candidate for voters who want that. Laura Ellsworth, you know, least well-funded candidate. She's a Pittsburgh lawyer. She's taken sort of a different route. Wouldn't call her a moderate. She still has many of the same positions as the other two, but she has stayed out of, you know, the kind of the nasty TV ads that they've been running, mostly because she didn't have money to run any ads until recently, I think. She's sort of billing herself as a candidate who is going to, you know, compromise when it's necessary and, you know, take different roads to get to the same place. For instance, she, you know, she supports redistricting reform, things that Democrats have largely looked to, and she's saying, no, it's just a good government reform. So that's, I suppose, you know, the overview of how they're handling this race, the three of them.
If you ask people on the street about this campaign, the three Republicans running for governor, I don't think there's any doubt that the first thing you would hear has to do with the commercials. That's what everyone has noticed. And you hear so many people saying that they're turned off by it. But are they really? I mean, will those commercials have an impact on voters?
I mean, I think there's no doubt. I mean, I think voters can be turned off by these commercials and also think, well, I got to pick one of the two. If they're a Republican voter,
or they could go with Ellsworth, who says I'm not in that.
Exactly. But again, Ellsworth just does not have the name recognition, and I think a lot of people see her as somebody who's not going to win. Maybe they don't want to vote for her because of that. It seems like she's an interesting logic there, but I do hear that from people. Ellsworth, too, when I was speaking to her, I met her at a farmer's market in Bryn Mawr, so right outside of Philly, and she was saying, like, wherever she goes, there are people who kind of, they, like, meet her, they kind of learn a little bit about her platform, and then she's like, they're like, oh, I didn't know that you existed, and they're happy to, you know, get right on board. There was one woman that I talked to who, like, wrote her a check on the spot. But, I mean, that being said, she's got a lot of ground to make up. So she does. I mean, she's, again, kind of far behind in fundraising. The other two have also, they're independently wealthy people. They've been able to put millions of their own dollars into their campaigns, as is, you know, sitting Governor Tom Wolf, all millionaires. So, she, you know, she's an outlier in that way. And she also, you know, just hasn't, you know, made the ad buys, been able to make the ad buys of the other two.
And has been endorsed by Penn Live, the Patriot News, and the Philadelphia Inquirer as well.
Yeah.
You know, two of the top newspapers or most read newspapers in the state.
She has.
Okay, so the other two, Wagner and Mango on the campaign trail, how are they received by voters? What do you hear? What did you observe?
Well, so it was interesting. I was trying to get Mango somewhere else, but I talked to both of them at the same event. It was the Chester County Republican dinner the other week. And Wagner, as the party endorsed candidate, was giving the keynote speech and had a lot of people up there, you know, along with him, endorsing him, like Lou Barletta, Congressman Lou Barletta, who's running for Senate, was up there, you know, the party chair, Val DiGiorgio. And so he was really kind of the center of attention. And then Mango was off. He was there. He was, you know, talking to people, talking to the Chester County Republicans. But he was, you know, standing in a corner for the speech.
Kind of awkward.
I mean, you know, it is what it is. And I think I asked him, you know, why come to this? And he's like, listen, it's the party that I also belong to. And it's the party that if I, you know, win this nomination, I'm going to need their support to beat Tom Wolf. So, you know, I think in his mind, it's sort of, you know, you got to go where you got to go.
So we're down to less than a week now.
Yes.
And I mean, with this campaign for governor, is there any last minute surprises that you're aware of, or has it, is it, every, anything, has everything pretty much been cast in stone at this point?
I think, you know, you never want to say anything's cast in stone. There's always room for surprises. Just yesterday, Wagner took a position on a relatively new abortion bill, a restrictive abortion bill, which I thought was a little bit interesting. All three of them say they're pro-life. And so this bill, it was sponsored by actually Representative Rick Saccone, who is running for Congress, ran for Congress before but lost. He calls it the heartbeat bill, and it was introduced late last year, but only came up now, which makes me feel like it really is kind of, you know, being billed as a campaign issue. So it would essentially outlaw abortions if the doctor can feel a heartbeat. So if a person goes in to get an abortion, doctor feels a heartbeat, abortion can't happen. And that's, as far as I could tell, there weren't any exceptions to that. I did read through the bill, but Saccone's office didn't get back to me. So I'm not, maybe there are exceptions, but I don't think so. So anyway, it's a highly restrictive abortion bill, sort of similar bills. And by the way, a heartbeat can usually be felt around 6 weeks of pregnancy, 6 to 8 weeks. And right now, the abortion limit's 24 weeks. So huge difference. Other states, when these kind of things have been, put out there, they've been vetoed, or not vetoed, rather, struck down by the courts. So Wagner came out and supported it. Mango said, well, I am pro-life, but I have to read it. And then Ellsworth said, no, it's a silly bill because it would get struck down by the courts immediately. So she said she wants to push for pro-life legislation that would actually survive a court challenge. So anyway, that's just another one of those issues where it's like you can kind of see where all these candidates are coming down on something. And if voters, say something like this kind of catches, wing and like people, see this as a divisive issue in the campaign, maybe it will make a difference. But at this point, I think we pretty much know where all three of these people stand.
One of the characteristics of a primary campaign, especially when you have so many candidates, is that very often, they're all members of the same party, very often there is not a whole lot of difference in the positions of the candidates.
It comes down to like personality.
Right. So with the three candidates for governor, can you point to any real differences issue-wise, position-wise?
There are a couple things. For instance, and sometimes the differences come out in places you wouldn't necessarily expect. Wagner supports raising the minimum wage. The other two don't. He says, not to the heights that Wolf wants to, but he says maybe $9.20 an hour would be acceptable. I think Mango, because he's billed himself as, the most conservative candidate, he's taken those positions. For instance, he personally opposes gay marriage and has said that a couple of times. He says he wouldn't go against the courts on that, but, that is one of his things. I mentioned before Ellsworth with redistricting reform. There's a couple other things that she wants to do. Actually, she voted for John Kasich for president, not Donald Trump, like the other two did, which I think people kind of look to as, a difference. She also wants to, route funding in different ways for charter schools and public schools so they don't have to compete against each other. And she opposes eliminating property taxes, which the other two do, because she thinks it would, again, destabilize schools. So there are policy differences, but I think there's no question that all three of these people are conservative Republicans. And also, you got to remember, when somebody gets into office, there are lots of other forces at work that, sort of goad them into acting a different way. A ton of Republicans want to get rid of property taxes, and so that might be something that comes up again, probably will, if a Republican governor were to take office.
Next Tuesday is primary election day, and I want to remind you, the interviews that we've done on Smart Talk over the past 3 weeks, we have all the audio on our website, WITF.org/elections, so that you can compare candidates. There are a lot of candidates out there this year. I think we made invitations to like 30 candidates, and about 22 of them actually responded to us. So if you want to go to if you want to hear where the candidates stand on the issues and make comparisons, you can go to WITF.org/elections. I want to turn to a couple other issues at the state capitol, Katie. Mm. Dave Reed, who is the House Majority Leader, Republican, actually was a candidate for Congress very early on and decided to pull out once the districts were changed by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. He is weighing in, though, on redistricting, congressional redistricting.
Yeah.
What did he say?
So Dave Reed, I think important context, is leaving at the end of this year. He is retiring, basically, from his role as majority leader and also just from the House generally. He says he wants to sort of tackle redistricting reform, which has been sort of a hot potato issue for Republicans. Many have said, oh, I would like to do redistricting reform. But when it comes down to it, they have not pushed it, you know, to the point where it can get past a committee. And so Reed says he would like to look at it. He doesn't like the bills Democrats are currently putting forward, which would create, you know, an independent commission where there's, you know, these people are appointed. He wants to do it basically like jury duty, where like people would be drafted out of the general population. You get a call, you go in and you see if you're going to sit on this commission. Obviously, you know, redistricting is a little bit more complicated than being a juror, I would say. But, you know, I think it's an interesting proposal. I think it's something that more Republicans would probably be on board with. Now, where this goes, I don't know. He has introduced legislation, or the bill is not introduced, but he's looking for co-sponsors on it right now. He says it's doing fine. I've checked in on it. But, you know, I mean, he is someone who's leaving, and it's going to be up to someone else to, you know, keep this legislation going and to champion it, because, you know, as we've said before, it needs a constitutional amendment to change redistricting in Pennsylvania. That means that the same bill has to be passed two sessions in a row, and then it has to go to the voters as a ballot measure. And so, you know, it's a really heavy lift. And so, you're going to have to inspire a ton of, a ton of agreement in this very divided legislature on this issue.
Well, part of the reason that I would say that, I don't know, I can't read Representative Reed's mind,
sure,
so I won't speculate there. But redistricting reform has been stopped dead in its tracks by Representative Daryl Metcalf,
yes,
who is chairman of the House State Government Committee.
Yeah.
And he had an email, or he had a Facebook post, mm-hmm, last week that went viral. One of the things he said in there is that he doesn't allow bills that have been introduced by Democrats,
yep,
to get through his committee. In fact, I think I read just the other day that one has made it through,
yeah,
that committee.
Yeah, so Metcalf has been that committee chair since 2011. And in that time, one bill sponsored by a Democrat got through that committee. It was a land use bill in 2014. So not a controversial issue. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that Metcalf has, you know, is very specific in how he runs this committee. And there's been two redistricting bills that have come up to him just recently, and he's basically gutted both of them and replaced him with his own language. And so obviously the Democrats now don't want them. So it's been a challenge for them to get redistricting across the line. I did speak to Metcalf briefly after Dave Reed said he wanted to do this, and he said, oh, well, you know, the majority leader and I have worked together in the past. Maybe we can work together on this.
Sense I got is that those who favor some kind of redistricting reform were a little more optimistic when Republican Dave Reed proposed something, even though it doesn't go as far as what many of them want.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good assessment.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, you know, we don't know how much, you know, weight Reed's going to put behind this, how hard he's actually going to work on it. I've talked to his spokesman. He says, no, he's very committed to this. But again, the guy's leaving, in, you know, the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to another issue. Governor Tom Wolf vetoed a bill that would create a drug formulary. First of all, what is that?
So basically, it's a list of drugs that are acceptable to be prescribed to people, and it's specifically for the workers' compensation program. So it's designed to, list acceptable drugs. Doctors will have to check that list. Employers will be able to say whether or not they think a drug is appropriate as well.
Why did the governor veto it?
So the bill is sort of billed as being something that would cut down on opioid abuse. So, you know, people would no longer be prescribed opioids in such high doses under the bill. maybe. It also, a very important, you know, side effect maybe of that, or maybe it's the full purpose, is that it would cut down costs in workers' compensation. So, and it's not just opioids that would sort of, you know, be phased out under this. It would be a lot of more expensive medications. And so Wolf and a lot of Democrats say, you know, this isn't appropriate. It kind of impinges on what doctors can prescribe, their, you know, ideas for what's appropriate. And it also, they claim, would route more money back to insurers. Republicans say no, it would not do that. But Wolf, you know, that's it.
Katie Myers, WYTF's Capitol Bureau Chief. Katie, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's our annual gardening program where you can call in, ask any questions having to do with green, I don't know, purple, yellow, flowers, whatever. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.